Chapter 28. You were going to kill someone, Chantrell said, as her cable car brachiated home, swinging through the lantern-bedecked brain coral growth of the canopy with the mulch hung below, dark except for a dappling of scattered fires. What? You had your gun half out of your pocket like you meant to use it. Not the way you showed it to me, not as a threat, but like you weren't going to say a word before you squeezed the trigger, like you were just going to walk up, put a bullet through someone and walk away. There'd be little point lying, would there? You have to start talking to me, Tanner. You have to start telling me something. You said I wouldn't like the truth because it would complicate things. Well, trust me, this is complicated enough. Are you ready to let some of that mask slip, or are we going to carry on this game? I was still playing the whole incident over in my head. The face had been that of Argent Rivage, and he had been standing only a few meters from me in a public place. Was it possible he had actually seen me all along, and was much cleverer than I had realized? If he'd recognized me, he could have left the area in the opposite direction while I walked around Methuselah. I'd been too fixated on the idea of him still standing up against the glass to pay enough attention to the people who had just left, so it was possible, yes. But in accepting that Rivage had been aware of my presence all along, I opened myself up to a far more unsettling set of questions. Why had he stayed there if he had already seen me, and how had we met each other so easily? I hadn't even been looking for him at that point. I was just getting the feel of the area before I began the real work of tightening the net. As if that was not enough, now that I reviewed the few moments which separated my discovery of Rivage from the moment when I realized he had left, I became aware that something else had happened. I had seen something or someone, but my mind had suppressed it, concentrating my attention on the imminent kill. I had seen another face in the glass, another face that I knew, standing very close to Rivage. She had erased the surface markings, but the underlying bone structure was reasonably intact, and her expression very familiar. I had seen Zebra. "I'm still waiting," Chantrell said. "There's only so much of that meaningful frown I can take, you know." "I'm sorry, it's just..." I found myself grinning. "I almost think you might like me for who I am."
"Don't push your luck, Tanner. Only a couple of hours ago you were pointing a gun at me. Most relationships that start like that tend to go downhill."
"Ordinarily, I'd agree. But you also happened to be pointing a gun at me, and your gun was considerably larger than mine."
Maybe." She sounded far from convinced. "But if we're going to take it any further, and make of that what you will, you'd better start elaborating on that dark and mysterious past of yours, even if there are things you don't really want me to know."
"Oh, there are plenty of those, believe me."
"Then get them out into the open. By the time we get back to my place, I want to know why that man was going to die. And if I were you, I'd seriously try and persuade me that he deserves it, whoever it was. Otherwise you might begin to slip in my estimation."
The car pitched and swayed, but I no longer found the motion really sickening. "He deserves to die," I said, "but I can't say he's a bad man. If I'd been in his place, I'd have done exactly what he did. Except done it professionally, I thought, and not left anyone alive afterwards."
"Bad start, Tanner, but please continue."
I thought about giving Chantrell the sanitized version of my story, before realizing that there was no sanitized version, so I explained about my soldiering days and how I had fallen into Kaweya's orbit. I told her that Kaweya was a man of both power and cruelty, but not genuinely evil, since he was also a man of trust and loyalty. It was not hard to respect him and to want to earn his respect in return. I suppose there was something very primitive about the relationship between Kaweya and me. He was a man who desired excellence in everything around him, in his surroundings, in the accoutrements he collected, in the way he chose his sexual partners, like Gita. He also desired excellence in his employees. I considered myself a fine soldier, bodyguard, liege, man-at-arms, assassin, whatever label suited. But only in Kaweya could I measure my excellence against any kind of absolute.
"A bad man, but not a monster," Chantrell said, "and that was enough reason for you to work for him."
"He also paid pretty well," I said.
"Mercenary bastard?"
"There was something else, too. I was valuable to him because I had experience. He wasn't willing to risk losing that wisdom by placing me in situations of undue danger. So a lot of the work I did for him was purely advisory. I hardly ever had to carry a weapon.
We had real bodyguards for that, younger, fitter, stupider versions of myself. And how did the man you saw in Esher Heights come into it? The man's name is Argent Rivage, I said. He used to live on Sky's Edge. The family's name's rather well established there. It's also an old name in the canopy. I'm not surprised. If Rivage already had connections here, that would explain why he managed to infiltrate the canopy so quickly, when I was still getting soaked down in the mulch. You're getting ahead of yourself. What brought Rivage here, and you, for that matter? I told her how Kaweya's weapons had fallen into the wrong hands, and how those wrong hands had used them against Rivage's family, how Rivage had traced the arms back to my employer, and his determination to exact revenge. That's rather honorable of him, don't you think? I have no quarrel with Rivage about that, I said, but if I'd done it, I'd have made sure everyone died. That was his one mistake, the one I can't forgive him for. You can't forgive him for leaving you alive. It wasn't an act of mercy, Chantrell. Quite the opposite. The bastard wanted me to suffer for failing Kaweya. Sorry, but the logic's just a little too tortuous for me. He killed Kaweya's wife, the woman I should have been protecting. Then he left Kaweya, Dietling, and me alive. Dietling was lucky. He looked dead. But Rivage deliberately left Kaweya and me alive. He wanted Kaweya to punish me for letting Geeta die. Did he? Did he what? She sounded like she was about to lose patience with me. Did Kaweya do anything to you afterwards? The question seemed simple enough to answer. No, obviously he hadn't, because Kaweya had died afterwards. His injuries had eventually killed him, even though they hadn't appeared particularly life-threatening at the time. So why did I find it difficult to answer Chantrell? Why did my tongue stumble on the obvious and something else come to mind? Something that made me doubt that Kaweya had died. Finally, I said, it never came to that, but I had to live with my shame. I guess that was a kind of punishment in its own right. But it didn't have to have happened that way, not from Rivage's perspective. We were passing through a part of the canopy now that resembled a solid map of the alveoli inner lung, endlessly branching globules, bridged by dark filaments of what might have been coagulated blood. How could it have been otherwise? I said. Maybe Rivage spared you because with you it wasn't personal. He knew that you were just an employee and that his argument wasn't with you but with Kaweya. Nice idea. And just possibly the right one. Has it occurred to you that you don't have to kill this man at all, and that you might owe him your life? I was beginning to tire of this particular line of debate. No, it hadn't, for the pure and simple reason that it's completely irrelevant. I don't care what Rivage thought of me when he decided to let me live, whether it was intended as a punishment or an act of mercy. It doesn't matter at all. What matters is that he did kill Geeta, and that I swore to Kaweya that I'd avenge her death. Avenge her death? She smiled humorlessly. It's also conveniently medieval, isn't it? Feudal honor and bonds of trust, oaths of fealty and vengeance. Have you checked the calendar recently, Tanner? Don't even pretend to understand any of this, Chantrell. She shook her head vehemently. If I did, I'd start worrying about my sanity. What in hell's name have you come here for? To satisfy some ridiculous promise, an eye for an eye? Now you put it like that, I don't see it as being particularly laughable. No, it's not remotely laughable, Tanner, it's tragic. To you, maybe. To anyone with an angstrom of detachment, do you realize how much time will have passed by the time you get back to Sky's Edge? Don't treat me like a child, Chantrell. Answer my damned question. I sighed, wondering how I had let things get so far out of control. Had our friendship just been an anomaly, an excursion away from the natural state of things? At least 3 decades, I replied, as if the time I was expressing was of no consequence at all, like a matter of weeks. And before you ask, I'm well aware of how much could change in that time, but not the important things. They've already changed. And much as I wish they would, they won't change back. Geeta's dead. Dietling's dead. Mirabelle's dead. What? I said Kaweya's dead. No, you didn't. You said Mirabelle's dead. I watched the city slide by outside, my mind buzzing, wondering what kind of state my head must be in for a slip of the tongue like that. That wasn't the kind of mistake you could easily ascribe to fatigue. The Houseman virus was clearly having a worse effect on me than I dared assume. It had gone beyond simply infecting my waking hours with shards of Sky's life and times, and was beginning to interfere with my most basic assumptions about my own identity, undermining my perception of self. And yet, even that was a comforting assumption. The mendicants had told me their therapy would burn out the virus before too long, yet the sky episodes were becoming more insistent. And why would the Houseman virus bother making me confuse events that had happened in my own past rather than skies? Why did it care if I confused Mirabelle with myself? No, not Mirabelle. Kaweya. Disturbed, not wanting to remember the dream I'd had, of the time when I'd been looking down on the man in the white room with the missing foot, I tried to recapture the thread of the conversation. All I'm saying is... What? All I'm saying is that when I get back, I'm not expecting to find what I left. But it won't be any worse. The people who mattered to me were already dead. The Houseman virus was really screwing me up. I was starting to see Sky as myself, and Tana Mirabelle was increasingly becoming... What? A detached third person? Not really me at all? I remembered my confusion at Zebra's, after I had been playing the chess game over in my mind, time and time again, how sometimes I appeared to win and sometimes I appeared to lose. But it had always been the same game. That must have been the start of it. The slip of the tongue just meant that the process had taken a step beyond my dreams, just like the Houseman virus. Disturbed, I tried to recapture the thread of the conversation. All I'm saying is, when I get back, I'm not expecting to find what I left. But it won't be any worse. The people who mattered to me were dead before I left. I think it's about satisfaction, she said, like in the old experientials, where the nobleman throws down his glove and says he demands satisfaction. That's how you function. I thought it was absurd at first, when I used to indulge in those experientials. I thought it was too comical to even be part of history, but I was wrong. It wasn't just part of history. It was still alive and well, reincarnated in Tana Mirabelle. She had replaced her cat's eye mask now, an act which served to focus attention onto the sneer of her mouth, a mouth I suddenly wanted to kiss, even though I knew the moment, if it had ever existed, was gone forever. Tana demands satisfaction, and he's going to go to any lengths to get it, no matter how absurd, no matter how stupid or pointless, or how much of a prick he ends up making himself look. Please don't insult me, Chantrell, not for what I believe in. It's got nothing to do with belief, you pompous oaf. It's just stupid male pride. Her eyes narrowed to slits, and her voice took on a new vindictiveness which I still managed to find attractive, from some quiet retreat where I observed our argument like a neutral spectator. Tell me one thing, Tana. One little thing which in all of this you haven't explained. Only the best for you, little rich girl. Oh, very incisive. Don't give up the day job for the cut and thrust of debate, Tana. Your rapier wit might be too much for all of us. You were about to ask me a question. It's about this boss of yours, Kaweya. He felt this urge to hunt for Ryvich himself when he learnt that Ryvich was moving south towards the... What did you call it? The reptile house? Go on, I said testily. So why didn't Kaweya feel he had to end the job? Surely the fact that Ryvich killed Gita would have made it even more of a personal thing for Kaweya. Even more a case of, dare I say it, demanding satisfaction. Get on with it. I'm wondering why I'm talking to you and not Kaweya. Why didn't Kaweya come here? I found it hard to answer, at least not to my own satisfaction. Kaweya had been a hard man, but he had never been a soldier. There were skills which I had learned on a level below recall, which Kaweya simply lacked, and would have taken half a lifetime to gain. He knew weapons, but he did not really know war. His understanding of tactics and strategy was strictly theoretical. He played the game well, and understood the subtleties buried in its rules. But he had never been thrown into the dirt by the concussion of a shell, or seen a part of himself lying beyond reach on the ground, quivering like a beached jellyfish. Experiences like that did not necessarily improve one, but they certainly changed one. But would any of those deficits have handicapped him? This was not war, after all, and I had hardly come well equipped for it myself. It was a sobering thought, but I found it hard to entirely dismiss the idea that Kaweya might have already succeeded by now. So why had I come here rather than him? He would have found it difficult to get off the planet, I said. He was a war criminal. His freedom of movement was restricted. He'd have found a way round it, Chantrell said. The troubling thing was, I thought she was right, and it was the last thing in the world I wanted to think about. It's been nice knowing you, Tanner, I think. Chantrell, don't... As the door of the cable car sealed us from each other, I saw her shake her head, expressionless behind that mask of cattish indifference. Her cable car lofted, hauling itself away with a series of whisking noises, underpinned by the musical creaking as the cable stressed and released like catgut. At least she had resisted the temptation to dump me in the mulch. But she had dumped me in a part of the canopy I had no knowledge of. What exactly had I been expecting? I suppose, somewhere at the back of my mind, was the thought that we might have ended up sharing a bed by the end of the evening. Given that we had commenced our affair by pointing weapons at each other and trading threats, it would certainly have been an unanticipated coda. She was beautiful enough, as well, less exotic than Zebra. Perhaps less sure of herself, a trait which undoubtedly brought out the protector in me. She would have laughed in my face at that, stupid male pride, and of course she would have been correct. But so what? I liked her, and if I needed justification for that attraction, it hardly mattered how irrational it was. "Damn you, Chantrell," I said without very much conviction. She had left me on a landing ledge, similar to the touchdown point outside Esher Heights, but significantly less busy. Chantrell's car had been the only one here, and now that was gone. A muted rain was descending, like a constant, moist exhalation from some great dragon poised over the canopy. I walked to the edge, feeling sky come down with the rain.